Okay, we're recording.
Thank you. Well, Vicky, John, Michael, thank you very much for agreeing to participate in this really very interesting national project, I think it is.
Date.
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, well, yes, shall I? Well, I can put it in now.
Yes, please.
It is the 16th of May at Birralee. And
the hill,
a terrible veil, and it is 11:25. Anyway, thank you very much for agreeing to participate. I was really keen that New England people would have the opportunity to understand a little better the significance of not just what we have here, but the thinking behind what you have done and the huge changes that you have wrought. And to progress quickly, what I hope I might do is to look at your background, John, and how you came to this, and Vicky, what you then brought when you married John to this sympathy of interests that developed during your married life. And then, of course, Michael, your contribution sometime further down the track. So if we could start with you, John, what would you say were the signal aspects of your childhood growing up that led you to be so involved with amending your landscape using trees?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess as a child, I was often in the garden working with my mother, or experiencing being roused on for damaging any plants and things like that. But I guess it was happening all around me. And then later on, because of the New England dieback, my father had started making an effort to plant some trees, and
can I just interrupt for a moment? This was pre the big awareness in the 1970s that your father's mm-hmm. awareness occurred, mm-hmm. wasn't it?
Yes.
So when do you think he saw the
well,
damaging?
I can remember as quite a young boy, my uncle, who was a scientist, and he lived in Canberra and Hobart. And he worked a lot on the Cyrex wasp, which yes. was a major problem in the Radiata pines. But he was also interested in a lot of the eucalypt, the little insects and things that mm. were on them. And he came to visit one Christmas, and we all hopped in the adults hopped in the station wagon, and younger kids hopped in the back. And so we sort of didn't really know what was going on, but we were kind of listening mm. in the background. And my uncles and my father took a trip out to where the beetles, the Christmas beetles, were defoliating the trees quite badly. And they sat there for a while after looking at the trees and the beetles and what have you, and discussed the amount of damage that was being done mm. and trying to figure out what it all meant in the future. So they were thinking about that then, and that would have been probably in about 1956 or mm-hmm. or a little later, perhaps it could have been as late as 1960, but I was still quite mm. young, and the effects of dieback were just starting to really gather momentum, and a lot of the particular patch of trees that they were looking at that day was a couple of acres of eucalypts, and there wasn't a tree of that left alive after another 10 or 15 years because mm. of the because mm. of the New England mm. dieback. So it was, I guess there was an awareness then for my father, and probably during the middle of 60s he started to plant a few trees in places on the farm. And then about the time I left school in 67, he'd sort of stepped up his efforts and actually netted in some 1 acre enclosures and planted trees in them. I think he did about six areas, and it probably cost him about $8 a tree to plant mm-hmm. them. But he thought that, you know, because they were losing so many of the other trees, we needed to try and do something to replace mm-hmm. them. And then I guess later on, after a couple of years here, we gradually looked at planting larger areas and planting them along fence lines. And I can't remember the fine detail, but I remember sort of discussing with my father at one stage how good it would be to have a line of trees along a particular fence line near the creek. And we discussed it a bit, and he capitulated to me to allow us to fence in. It was only a narrow strip, just a single row of trees, but we planted those there, and I was quite involved in that. And I guess it sort of, it was sowing the seeds for me of getting involved in a larger scale project. Yeah.
Exotic or native? Those first trees?
Particular plantings, I don't think there were any natives they put in because all the natives were dying. Mm-hmm. And they were, as I remember it, they were largely Caprese. Mm-hmm. And the old Macrocarpus and some Turuloses. And I think we put in a few, I don't know whether it was one of the hawthorn.
And the Washington thorn.
Yeah, it might have been the Washington thorn that we put in. Mm-hmm. And there were a few poplars put amongst them, some of the Lombardy poplars. So, yeah, that was the beginning of it. And then about 1970, I suppose, we started to look at the... It was a little bit later, probably the radiata pine.
Yeah, 79 was the first time.
79 was, we'd planted a few more small areas in the meantime, but then in about 79 we looked at planting, you know, getting hold of some of the radiata pine that were being grown at the Walker Nursery, and we discovered that there were people machine planting those for the plantations, and... Being very mechanically minded, it interested me straight away that, you know, I could combine tree planting with a machine, and, you know, it was going to satisfy two interests. And some little plots that were round about on the farm that had been used for growing a bit of lucerne for the milking cows and that, we planted some of those areas out completely to radiata pine.
And by this time, of course... And by this time, you were married and you had another input.
That's right.
And Vicky, if we could just pause with the tale, because from that point on, it's really the your joint efforts, isn't it? From the time of the replanting of the lucerne. So, Vicky, I know that you had a very... interesting family background in garden and tree culture yourself, didn't you? So what did you come to this site? What do you think you brought to it?
I had never been or lived anywhere much that hadn't been surrounded by beautiful gardens and vegetation. Thinking earlier today about it, even in Sydney, I had relatives down there that we would visit. And my dad's uncle owned the Epping Nursery, so he had a huge area in the middle of Epping. And another uncle, great uncle, who used to visit, first thing he did was show me his vegetable garden and talk about how old his rhubarb plants were. So I just didn't know anything else. And so coming here, I can remember Mum and Dad arriving with a bootload of plants every time. And, well, they couldn't stay in the laundry tub forever. They had to be planted. So we started our garden, but they encouraged us, and John's parents encouraged us. And,
you came from a household where trees were immensely important.
Yes. It's just unimaginable to be anywhere without them. And not just any trees. There was always discussions about the types and what grew. And my mum, very early on in the piece here, would talk about a particular species of tree, like the oaks, that seemed to do well. So why not explore the family of oaks and collect one way or another, a wider range of that particular type of tree?
Perhaps we should... make the point that Noeline had a very particular interest in trees and, in fact, in time established her own arboretum and was a member of the Dendrological Society.
Yes.
So there was quite a strong intellectual interest in trees,
I guess from an early time we learnt to call names by their trees by their botanical name rather than a common name, because we knew the pitfalls of sticking to common names, which meant that it was easy then for us to approach nurseries further afield and to go and visit nurseries or gardens or forests and get to know the types of trees and their habits to see what would grow here. But we tried anything and everything for a start, including a lot of noxious weeds, probably.
We even planted gorse and, that was all right until my son saw it. One plant out of about eight that I planted survived, and it was growing a little bit. And as soon as I went away, he got the tractor and blade and dug it out.
Were there other individual or groups of trees that were spectacularly unsuccessful?
Yeah. Yeah, there were a lot of...
That's my chapter.
You remember to bring to introduce it a little later on, Michael. Yes, so, well, we'll proceed with the positive comments for a little while. So when...
We found that every year was different. So if you planted a wide range of things, something would grow and something would die. And you could never tell beforehand which species wouldn't do well. So,
some plants even that were a problem in some areas, people would say, "Oh, don't plant any of them because you know they get out of control and they take over the place and that sort of thing." But yeah, those same plants planted in another area can be quite a useful tree cover, things like. Like experimenting with pampas and
which doesn't
seem to seed and Contagious. Spread here, and some areas it is a problem. And then the gorse obviously battles to survive here, but there was also there was another one we tried that I can't think of it just for the moment, but there was
I wonder at what time you looking back, you can say that you developed a more systematic approach to rather than the hit and miss.
No, it wasn't never. Systematic. It was more experimental all the way, and looking and learning from other people's experience and trying it here, because we had nobody to follow here, and. This area is right on top of the Tablelands, so we don't have good water. The soils are thin, and because it was denuded of trees, the extreme temperatures in winter and summer were getting worse each year. So nobody could advise us. And when we first started, there was only the Forestry Commission. And they were only interested in plantation trees, and they only knew about plantation trees.
Where was the nearest Forestry Commission?
Walker. So,
yes.
Yeah. We had some really good people there that were very, very helpful, but they had a narrow view. So it was only when we were able to travel to Victoria, we thought, wow, look at the vegetation trees down here. How do they get these things to grow? And they had nurseries where you could get these trees. We didn't have the nurseries up here either. People like Gordon and Yeomans and those, if we'd had them, well, it would have been easy.
Easier.
We had to grow our own, propagate all our own trees.
That's something else we should talk about. From the beginning, you were not having special nurseries on the place. You were planting straight into sites after a tube.
We planted silver poplars from rootstock that we dug up along the side of the road, that patch near Somers, one at Kentucky Station. We planted the radiata pine that was open-rooted, and then we found nurseries in Victoria that grew trees that you could buy in big numbers cheaply, and they were open-rooted, so we could get them transported up here cheaply and in the ground soon after they arrived. And the rest we grew from cuttings. We soon found that we could grow the poplars and willows from cuttings.
There was a very strong emphasis in the whole thing of, for me in particular, to trying to find ways that we could afford to plant large numbers of trees, because we weren't doing it as a funded thing. And so we're constantly looking for varieties that you could get cheaply. And, for instance, the radiata pine, were at that stage, they were 8 cents a seedling. Mm-hmm. And so if you bought any sort of tube stock, it was $2 a seedling, full stop. And it's still cheaper than that now with better propagation systems. But, you know, finding ways to, like planting the poplars from cuttings or direct seeding some of the Quercus species with the acorns. And and that the other thing, apart from looking at the cheaper thing, was to find things that actually grew here. And because there were a lot of trees that we did plant that initially that didn't grow, well, we just kept broadening our view, and it was kind of exciting. You know, look, we found something else, and that's a really nice tree. Let's take some seed of that and see if we can grow some of them. Or
this is a different species.
Yeah, totally different species. Whether it was, fruit tree seedlings, we discovered, Granny Smith seedlings that they grow en masse in nurseries for the people to use as rootstock to graft onto. And we were able to buy those trees and we just planted them as rootstock. And they came up, and some of them had Granny Smiths, and some of them had some other varieties we'd never seen. And but it was all part of, you know, building up the diversity and finding what things we could grow and what we couldn't.
Yeah. And, of course, as you found the better sources of supply, you also had then the problem of numbers to plant.
Yes.
So your interest in mechanics was very useful.
Yeah, well, it was... always had an interest in being able to... I didn't like the idea of having to walk along with a shovel and dig a hole for everyone. So mechanising the planting method, it was obviously we ended up planting in rows because we could use a tractor and a ripper and a rotary hoe and things like that to be able to plant the trees in a mechanised fashion. And then later on, spent some time developing machines where you could insert the trees into those prepared plant lines.
And then something that we haven't brought up yet is finding the Heiko propagation system. So that totally transformed what we were doing here, in that we were able to plant greater numbers of a wider variety of trees and get really good strike rates.
So explain that system.
We'd started trying to grow the oaks, and we found very quickly that they've got a very strong taproot, like a eucalypt, and when it hits the bottom of a pot, it goes around and around and becomes root-bound. And so we were planting acorns into the longest milk cartons we could buy and putting those into a vegetable garden. But when we found that taking them out of the vegetable garden, they were really hard to manage, and you would damage the root systems, and it was difficult to get them planted. So, John, you came across the Swiss roll
thing in a
book or something?
Collecting some seed while we were in America, and we went to a nursery that had a lot of Pinus and Quercus species, and they were selling seed. And one of the gentlemen there, when we arrived, he took us for a walk around in the nursery, which was growing, you know, perhaps 4 million plants or something like that, all in containers. And he showed us these containers and how you could lift the seedlings out, and they were using them to grow their oak species for plantations. And the more I thought about it, even by the time I left, I was pretty sure that was something that was going to be pretty interesting. So we kept in touch with him and got him to send a few trays, and we experimented with them, and then we asked if we could buy some trays, and we ended up making contact with the Swedish company that manufactures them. And then, for a period of 10 years...
What's the distinctive feature of those as compared with tube stock or milk cartons?
Yeah, well, the trees are air-pruned in these trays. So the tray is supported above the ground, and it has a hole the size of my thumb in the bottom, and it's only 90cc, so it's only a little tiny pot. There's a tray, I've got 40 of these cells, and they've all got that hole, and they're sitting above the ground, and you keep watering them and feeding them, and the roots all grow down the side wall, but then when they come out in the air, they air prune. And so you end up with a tight knot of roots, but they're not circling. They're all trained to grow down the sides to the bottom. And then you can pick up the tray. You've got 40 trees in one hand, and you can pull them out really easily and just put them in a hole. And they use a tool called a pot of putki to put them in, and it's like a duck bill that you push into the soil, and it opens. And you drop the tree down the tube. You don't even have to bend over. And we were able to use those. We'd already started bare root planting, and with the bare root planting, you've got a ripper that you pull along through the soil, and it opens the soil out, and you can put the tree down behind the ripper, and then two press wheels close the soil. And you could use these Hyco seedlings in the same principle. So we decided that was something we wanted. And
reduce the cost of the seedling better survival rates.
What sort of date was this? Which decade?
1990s. So we started to sell the trays at Tree Fest in 92. So we brought in a shipping container.
We bought a shipping container. The people in the factory in Sweden were quite fascinated. They'd heard that there was an order for some of these trees, to a container load of these trees, which is many cells in a 20-foot container.
And, I'm staggered, even at this distance.
The poor guy over there, he rang and he said, John Taylor. John said, said, you've ordered a container of Hyco trays. Mm. John said, yes. He said,
"What sort of trees are you growing?
What are you doing?
Yeah.
And John said, "Well, I'm a sheep farmer."
And we're experimenting. We reckon these trays are going to work really well. Oh, yes. So, how many trees are you... Oh, well, we're going to grow, quite a number, and I reckon I can sell the rest to other people around. Oh, rightio. We ended up buying many, many... As a separate business, we ended up bringing in many, many large container loads of these and selling them to a lot of nurseries all around the state. We had even state forests in New South Wales still use that tray system. And,
My goodness.
And APM in Victoria, a lot of other big nurseries adopted it. And so that helped sort of keep us afloat financially while we were busy planting trees.
Yeah, that's really well how it funded our tree planting, I guess. You know, we could justify planting trees because we had this side business. And again, we were meeting, we were travelling, meeting people.
And could we just elaborate on that a little? Because what you did, you were plainly very open-minded and keen to search. Where did you go in... apart from the district and the state and Gippsland?
Victoria was the start, but we started to collect the acorns from the Waite Institute down in Adelaide and Canberra, the street trees. Canberra was a great source of acorns. And then we got to know Bill Funk down in Victoria at Dunkeld, who has a huge arboretum of... tree collection, and he told us that Mexico had the largest collection of oak species, and at that time he couldn't afford to go anywhere, and he probably saw us coming as suckers. You need to go over there. And oh, we thought, oh, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. So we
was there
to,
a commission of acorns in this advance?
Oh, yes, we had to. Yes, he'd given us a lot of trees, mm-hmm. and we had to bring back acorns for him.
Yes.
He even collected some here last year off our trees.
And there were other people down in Vic. There was a guy in Melbourne growing in his backyard, really, all sorts of different types of oak trees. And we visited him.
Nick Edpriest, wasn't it?
Yeah, my mum, she got a lot of trees from Bill and from Nick Edpriest. But we went to the eastern coast of America and Mexico and collected a lot of acorns and trees there. That's the only time we've collected plant material outside the country. And now it's virtually impossible.
We had to do quite a bit of work preparing that, and we contacted the quarantine folks and found out what was necessary to be able to bring them in. And then we had an esky, and even on the flight back from the States, I spent quite a bit of time in my seat with the esky on my lap and pulling out packets of seed and checking, because they were, you know, we'd recently collected them.
Yes.
And because it was a bit warm, you know, just carrying it in the esky,
some of it
was already starting to put a shoot out. And if there were any shoots on seeds,
yeah,
I had to pull them out and put them in the, you know, in the B-stick bag in the back of the seat. And then when we got them to Sydney, they had to all be labelled with their varieties.
Botanical names.
Varieties they were and all that sort of thing. And we had no trouble bringing them in, and we still wonder how well they actually checked them at the time. You know, we had to give them the whole thing to check.
I don't think they did it all,
and they did
really.
That, but they did it so quickly that I don't reckon they...
And we couldn't believe our luck. We just threw them in the car and took them home. Woo!
Yes, I've done the same thing. I have checked. I have beforehand and had them all properly
labelled.
Yeah,
it's not labeled. Difficult if you do the right thing.
I think probably they also look at the people who are likely to be doing things, wanting to do things by the book.
Yeah, but it has changed a lot. Bill Funk, he used to collect cutting material and seeds from all over the world, and he can't do it now.
He's well known for his collecting, and yet he can't get stuff in. It's not fumigated anymore, so
you have to grow it out.
So
in
we were lucky to be able to expand the. You know, there's probably out of the 80 odd varieties of oak that we've tried, there's probably only 50 of those that are actually ones that you could collect in Australia.
Reasonably
easy.
No, it was
the others were all ones we had to get in the States or Mexico because there's not.
Yes, it is a demonstration of how conscientious you have been in not just checking the legalese for importing, but the determination to travel and to get the widest possible range of species to
we didn't
try.
Really do it as a plan, you know, it was something that we loved doing and we found really interesting and it was a great excuse for a lot of the travelling. So, we didn't set out to create the garden that we've got or to introduce that many different plants to the
Nevertheless, you know, a man's hobby has eventually to be justified economically.
That's right.
And but just before we get onto that, I want to just go back to the business of the planting. You, clearly most of your things have been species have been planted in lines or in blocks or but on your aerial photographs you can also see there are contour plantings. What's the philosophy behind that, as distinct from the lines and blocks?
Well, it was a progression. And once again, it was driven largely by the costing, you know, trying to do it as cheaply as possible. So we started off with small fenced-off lines along boundary fences of paddocks or the farm, and then we could see that they weren't necessarily always planted in the best spot for trees to grow, you know. So we started looking for specific places on the farm where the soil was perhaps not quite so productive, or where it was a hilltop that was very exposed, and we'd fenced off a block, probably a rectangle or a square, and we started planting them there because there was less fence for the number of trees and that you were planting. And then later on, after a little bit of experimenting, but quite a bit of sort of looking and thinking about it for several years, we decided that we should be able to take a whole paddock and not put any fences in, just plant where we want the trees.
Yeah, but before that, we did plant some along the slope to provide more shelter across a paddock.
Mm.
And we did have a visit from Ron Watkins from Western Australia.
Yeah.
And he looked at those lines along the slope and he said, but you haven't planted them on the contour.
Mm.
We said, no. And he said, well, maybe you should look at doing that, because that way you provide shelter without creating wind tunnels.
Mm.
And you actually went over to his place. Yep. And
at that stage we were selling forestry equipment in Western Australia and doing some consulting with the company as an agent for the company that made the trays. And while I was over there, I went and visited this particular farmer who used the key line plan, the yeoman's key line plan, which was quite a well-known innovation, where they tried to do all their farming on the contour and catch the water flow instead of it running down the furrows. And they were around the contour, so the water sort of accumulated and sank in. And that I could see a lot of merit in that. That was a bit before Tree Fest, and then he came over here for Tree Fest as one of the guest speakers. And when we looked around, he made some more suggestions, and you could still, at that stage, I was still trying to figure out, you know, whether we could actually take out big enough paddocks out of production for a couple of years and then gradually put the stock back in once the trees had started to grow.
And it was almost always mixed economies in your planting, whether they were lines or blocks.
Yes, we used radiata as the main tree because it was the cheapest and easiest and had the best survival rate, and it also would
have had a timber value too.
Yeah, and then we tried other species, and then we were able to gradually plant more natives because the pines were providing the shelter and it was easier to get the natives to survive. And at that stage too, there were nurseries starting to grow the native plants.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kentucky Tree Nursery, we had our own nursery here, and we advertised for somebody to grow under contract for us because we could see, you know, we didn't have the time to do that. And Chris Everly at Kentucky took up the challenge, and he's still doing it. Yeah, and so he would grow for us, and anything extra, we said, well, you know, go for it, sell them yourself. So he was a terrific person to work with, and he very quickly learnt a lot too about what grew where and species, collecting the seed and things like that. So we worked with him for a long time, getting a lot of
interest. Now, Michael, you've been sitting very patiently listening to all of this, which is
taking notes,
which is obviously in the family, in the blood. You were probably born with this. Where do you see your consciousness appear in the story we've heard of your parents so far? What point do you begin to take an interest?
Like both my parents, I've grown up knowing of only knowing big gardens and then from beyond the garden fence, the all the trees in the landscape, whether it was building cubby houses or being dragged along in winter to plant trees or something to do with propagating or collecting cuttings. I remember collecting poplar cuttings along the highway and then acorns and now, you know, eucalypt seed and whatever else we can find and propagating acacias. I remember growing acacias in my cupboard when I was at boarding school as part of the tree fest. One of the competitions at tree fest was who could grow an acacia the biggest in a certain time period. So I had an acacia growing in my cupboard, much to the suspicion of the boarding house staff, and I didn't win. I spent too cold in my boarding room, but yeah, I think
on
it's
that school.
I think it's, yeah, it's just, you know, I'm privileged to, and I can really see that now. I'm very privileged to have just grown up with that as and it's much easier to take it to the next step, and I can see, I've been able to see the trials and tribulations that my parents have gone through, whether it was the ground preparation or the planting techniques or the propagation issues or the selection of species, including fertilizer application. And I was tasked with that it was thought that there was a boron deficiency on, and there is a boron deficiency on one side of the property, and I'm trying to get boron into the pine trees, and myself and another Irish bloke were sent out to spread a little bit of boron on the pines, and I guess that's where I started killing trees. We managed to burn quite a few trees with boron. As many trees that have survived, we've also seen a lot die. And I think now, you know, with the drought we had in 2013-14, we were seeing a lot of trees that were 20 or 30 years old starting to die out, just because they'd never faced dry conditions like that. It was those couple of years that we lost most of our birches on the property. Mm-hmm. And a lot of willow species that had never seen it that dry, and since then I've experimented with sequoias, mm-hmm. and I managed to kill 100% of those. We've got one just outside the studio that we're sitting in now that's 30 plus years old, and it's a magnificent specimen of a tree, and but yeah, I managed to kill 200 of them, and they were either eaten off by roos or frosted or killed by the heat and the dry. So
experimenting's still going on.
Experimenting's going, but yet at the same time, I've had my fair share of successes as
well.
So
what are they? And what do you see as your particular contribution in the success?
Well, look, I guess yeah. Persistence. More. I've been able to draw on a lot of the successes of my parents.
Yeah.
So I've put in contour plantings and also plots of blocks of pine trees for timber production. As I was saying earlier, that my first biggish planting, 2 hectare planting of 3,000 Pinus radiata, and we'd done all the ground preparation and the fencing and the weed control, grass control, and went out with my father and I, and we planted the 3,000 trees in a morning in 4 hours, and my father told me that I'd get up to speed one day. So this is my first attempt. I thought we were doing pretty well. Over on our other block that my sister Catherine now runs, we'd seen plots of pines do particularly well in some areas over there, and established one nearly 10 hectare pine forest, mostly planted on the contour. It was a granite ridge that had produced some really good timber. So I'm talking a lot about forestry because that's just after I came back to the property. My father had done a lot of research into sawmills. We'd already been producing peeled pine posts off the property out of the thinnings from pine plantings. And the next stage is obviously sawn timber. So this is working towards what my parents imagined might be one of the economic benefits from a lot of the trees they were planting. So in the first few years back here, there was still a lot of emphasis on establishing and managing pine trees. So there was lots of pruning and thinning and tree selection and planting. And one of those plots now has got trees in it that's only 10 years ago, and there's trees in there that have 30 centimetre diameters. It's just phenomenal. And
Can I just pause at that? That particular example of a success, I presume, well, you tell me what you think the inputs are to the particular success of that. What elements were what made it so successful?
Well, as we've seen, as my father mentioned, site selection was a really big thing, and we've got so many examples on the property now where particular tree species grow or they don't grow, and types of soils they grow in, and I guess just having that sense of observation. Being able to see what grows well where, and was something that led, I think, was probably the main success.
Experience
in that. Understanding the important elements in establishing trees and good ground preparation and weed control and pest management. I've probably gone on and I've taken on the odd project that's probably been a little bit larger than I could handle, but I've also faced some seasonal variations that have also taken the experimenting to another level. You know, similar species but different seasons. Again, I think one of the key tipping points was the drought of 2013-14, when we saw a lot of tree species dropping out, but also in tree establishment. It was one of the first times I decided to give corflute, the tall corflute guards, the triangular corflute tree guards, a go. And I was trialling them next to, so this was mainly on natives. This was all on natives, actually. Trialling them next to milk cartons that had been the standard form of protection. And that year we had absolutely no green grass pretty much left on the property. And everything that was in a 600mm corflute guard was chewed off at 600mm. Everything that was in a 20 centimetre milk carton was chewed off at 20 centimetres. There was no shoots left behind. And it was just small things like that made you think more about other ways that you could establish trees. And we'd been not long after it was visiting properties down in the Otways where they were using tall plastic tubes on, you know, this is like 2-3 metre high tubes to establish trees to prevent roos and deer from browsing on the trees. So yeah, I think the experimenting just went to another level, and But I had the advantage of seeing everything that my parents had achieved, or and the successes and the failures, and things like the lifespan of acacias on the property. We were seeing a lot of acacias come to the end of their life, so acacias falling over fence lines and things like that were a big thing to consider. It was very costly, having to cut acacias off fence lines, so I vowed never to plant wattles next to fence lines again. But even pine trees next to fence lines, seeing some pine trees starting to come down, it's made me think much longer term. And then seeing the trees that my grandfather planted and seeing how they've been going and what they're doing. And so the oaks are definitely, a big part now. I'm propagating a lot of oaks, and one of the reasons is I'm seeing a lot more longevity in that species. But I'm keeping my eye out for a whole range of other species too. I think, again, I've had the advantage of seeing all the things my parents have planted.
In the discussion so far, there's been very little mention of fertilizers.
Well, we did, when we first started off, we were able to buy some fertilizer in that first or second year that was called a Poplar Special, and it was developed for a lot of the people that were doing poplar plantations down in the Kempsey and Grafton areas, and probably elsewhere down on the Murray, and that I think there were a lot of poplar plantations as well. And we tried using that, and it certainly boosted the growth, but there were a lot of issues, like it was hard to put it on in a manner that didn't risk burning the tree if it was too close, or being totally wasted and fed to the grass, as it were, if it was not in the right spot. So we decided that it pushing them along too made them more susceptible to frost damage, and frost damage is quite severe here. We're regularly seeing in this area more than 20 degrees between daytime and nighttime temperature in this area, and I think compared to a lot of other areas, it can make quite a difference to the damage by the frost. To have a 25 degree day when the plant's really jumping and ready to go in the spring, it starts, the sap's starting to move and everything, and then overnight it'll be -2 or even -5 sometimes. It gets up over 25 degrees difference, even, as you know. So not pushing them along quite so quickly with fertilizer was thought that maybe it was a good idea to stay away from that. We also, as Michael said, we had some problems with boron.
But then the pines were actually treated with the boron
as they
came out of the nursery, so we didn't have to use boron once we planted them.
They start to feed the trace element into them in the nursery.
That definitely made a big difference too.
And your selection of trees is really being tailored to the condition of the soil that they're going into.
Yeah, I think it's the ground preparation we found was more important than anything else. And even people ask if we watered the trees after we planted them. Sometimes we've had to water them in that we give them, we have been known to give them a litre of water just to seal the soil around the seedling. But we've never gone back much at all to water them later.
Except in 2013, 2014, that was the first time ever I'd known of going back and doing a second water in January.
The ground preparation was done effectively, we found we didn't really...
The condition of the soil was optimal for the storing the maximum amount of water.
Weed control is a big thing up here in New England, grass control, like competition.
We found we had to do a spring planting, the autumn planting here, it was too rough on the seedlings to plant them, and then they go into a, you know, 5 month period nearly when the frosts are so severe that they can't grow. And so, you know, the hares and rabbits are willing to nibble them down a bit, and the frosts are belting them down, and they're getting, you know, you plant them and they get smaller and smaller for the next 4 or 5 months.
Which has been a big difference with a lot of the work that had been done already down south in Victoria or the Southern Highlands, is a lot of their seasons are around the other way and they're getting moisture into the winter. So even up here, it's limited to the tablelands, because the further north you go, it's obviously, it changes again. If you go out west, it's different as well, and down on the coast. So we've had to learn a lot of things that are quite particular to the New England tablelands.
The hyco system made a difference there too, because you could plant in the early spring and the plants would start growing immediately. So they were able to handle the higher temperatures
The thing about spring planting too is that that's the time when all the other grasses and things like that are going to be taking off most quickly and competing. So it was particularly important to make sure that the ground preparation was, and the wet grass control as part of the ground preparation was done really well. And we found any years where we had that done almost perfectly, we got very good results, even if it was a dry year. But if there was a bit of a breakdown and there was a lot of weed growth coming in the planting lines, well, it was often hard to get a good...
So when you talk about grass control, this means tillage. That they're starting on a level playing field, both the tree and the grass. The grass doesn't have the advantage.
Yeah, it was a regime we found that was the most successful, was to spray it out with... Mostly we used Roundup and sprayed it out, and then we had ripped it maybe before, but maybe after, and then we rotary hoed it, which further controlled anything that had germinated after that. And then we used a residual spray that was not affecting the trees, and we had a few different combinations for different types of trees. And by putting that residual on, we could get right through the spring period without any grass growth coming. So it was often the tree had it to itself. It had all the moisture in that metre-wide strip, probably until Christmas time, and then after that, if it was moisture in the summer, there'd be starting to be a bit of grass coming, but the tree was that well established by then that it could handle the competition.
And the rotary hoeing made a big difference, because it gave you a good planting bed, as well as the residual spray would be more effective when the ground was flat. So we always talked about the fact that you don't grow your tomato seedlings in the middle of the road. You dig up a bed, you know, and rotary hoe it and till it, whatnot, to have a really good planting bed. And we do the same with the trees. Yeah.
Do you have any observations to make about the actual structure of the soil and determining how water retentive it is?
I think... I could definitely say, you know, even again, I keep referring to the 2013-14 drought, but that was a very dry period, and some of the ground preparation we did for that, we got through to probably February, March, and I actually had a group out here as part of the Master Tree Growers course that was being run here, and we went out to one of the sites, and I was able to quite clearly show everybody how much moisture was in the ground in the areas that we'd ripped and prepared and controlled the grass. There was still moisture in the soil there. You could have dug anywhere else and there was no moisture, because the grass had sucked it dry. But in the prepared ground, there was still moisture to be able to
To stay in the tree.
Yeah, it was important too. It wasn't just one rip line, it was three rip lines. So that you're breaking up the structure of the soil.
Yes.
You know, in a good metre.
We aimed to have a trough of soil that was 18 inches or 2 feet across, and you could with your bare hand, you could dig down, you know, a foot in that quite easily. So it was easy for the plant to, to establish roots.
There was a lot of, in the early days, even going back to the 90s and Tree Fest, again, coming out of Victoria, they'd already done a lot of work on direct seeding natives as a very effective way of planting trees cost effectively. But we've found in a lot of sites on the New England, direct seeding has had a very mixed result in terms of success, and we do have a direct seeded site, but it was a site where the grass wasn't as competitive, and but a lot of the other places, and there's still properties still attempting to direct seed and not having the success that they do down in Victoria and in other. In other areas, which is why we haven't done a whole lot of direct seeding. But a lot of people still ask us why we haven't done more direct seeding. We're having it's been a different story with direct seeding the oaks, because the acorns are quite a large have a large kernel, and there's quite a bit of they do a lot of their root establishment during the winter, and so even when the summer grasses get up quite high, the roots of those have been well down beyond the grass, and we've actually found the oaks doing perfectly fine in areas where we've done no grass control at all, and they're even possibly being protected from some of the animal browsing that's happened. So it's been an interesting to compare those things as well.
On the matter of subject of comparisons, I know that you are all very modest people, but you must have looked over the farm fence and had instructive lessons about what other people were suffering that you felt was modified on your place because of the trees.
Yeah, but you wouldn't dare say anything.
No, of course. let's look at your own property as you develop it. The areas where you have practiced most assiduously this tree culture, you would have noticed an improvement in either stock carrying capacity or grass retention for pastures, or where you've got a mature planting system around.
We've had every field day and gathering and meeting that we've ever been to, there's always discussions about that, and we've had a lot of discussion with Martin Oppenheimer, who lives next door. His management style is different to ours. He thinks he's done the right thing, and we think we've done the right thing, but obviously he hasn't changed doing what he's doing. The family around about, the older members, did quite a lot of tree planting when we were doing our tree planting, but the younger ones have been through agricultural colleges, and have obviously been taught, you know, a lot of way to do things, and it's always fascinating. But like I was saying to Lynn earlier, you never know till 100 years down the track whether you're doing the right things. So you can't swear that you've got the right system and somebody else hasn't. Obviously, the general consensus is that some people are mining the farmland, and other people are trying to restore it to a more sustainable level. But I think here personally, our mantra has been to be able to leave the farm in a better state than when we took over, and that's it.
And this multi-generation input and
makes it a lot easier.
Yes,
because you've got a greater time span to work on something.
You have the received wisdom of multi-generations.
Mm.
And you have the example of multi-generations working in generally the same direction. So, in a young country like Australia, of course, that is often very, very rare. And it's even more rare to have the next generation agreeing that the former generation has been on the right track. And so you get a wild oscillating or veering from one system to another, whereas this place is obviously benefiting from its third generation of sympathy of interest.
Yeah, it is interesting to look back over the history and our forefathers here on this land. They actually had to reduce the number of trees to be able to grow more grass because it had, you know, a 90% tree cover. And so they set to and they took some of the trees away and only cultivated small areas because they didn't have the machinery to do more than that. And then later on, when it came to like my father's generation, they were the ones that started to put out the fertiliser. That was the thing that was their sort of expertise at that time. And they added the fertiliser and the stocking rates went up and they did more fencing and the place was fairly humming, but then towards the end of that, the problems of New England dieback, which had largely arisen from that that era, that started to kick in and become a major problem. So they were starting to put a few, you know, try a little bit of tree planting, and then we felt that our generation has probably mostly contributed to re-vegetating the farm. And then Michael's generation is still battling with whatever's coming, and you know, they've had some difficult seasons as well. So,
but you had the 96 drought that was so
yeah. We've had intense dry periods.
Yeah, there've been droughts, but there have been some more prolonged periods of difficult rainfall patterns. I think since.
Yeah, I think it's gradually like getting drier, so each dry period is just slightly longer and
compounding the effect.
Yeah,
of the
and
last
when it does rain, it doesn't rain quite so much. So you're battling with that. Right. But thinking about all of this, it's all very well to try and measure everything in terms of economics, production. But the aesthetics play such a huge part in it. And coming from gardening families, I think that has also played a large part in what we're doing. And we're certainly getting the pleasure from it now because it looks, you know...
It feels good.
Yeah, it feels good. And
even Michael, I think, commented that... I think Michael commented at some stage that perhaps he mightn't have come back to the farm if it hadn't had any trees on it.
Yeah, the social benefits are just starting to be realised, and we've actually just taken part in another national project in terms of I think the evidence is slowly building over generations of the benefits of what has been going on here, but it may not be for another one or two generations before a lot of those benefits are fully realised in agricultural landscapes and education. There's definitely plenty of literature and field days and workshops, but farmers are still reluctant to take the plunge. I think the long-term thinking is hard for a lot of them to get their head around. But the research project we've just taken part in has brought in a lot of the social benefits, and they've got a huge number of metrics that they're able to objectively measure now, and they can be translated into economic terms, and I think those economic terms are always easier for farmers to justify than just, well, it looks nice.
Because
I like planting oaks because they're pretty colours.
We like it, but most other people don't notice. I mean,
they're counting the.
Yes, this is the garden history coming in.
That's right. Yes,
we've all got that in spades, and that has been one of the underlying drivers.
But that's not everybody,
drivers.
Is it? It's only most people would wonder why you bother.
That's right. But I'm even planting oaks that I know are not only beautiful, but the potential value of the timber in those alternative species is something I think might encourage others to take an interest in it, because there's a side to planting trees that there are a lot of economic benefits beyond just
carbon.
Beyond
retention,
aesthetics.
Yeah,
I mean,
all that's
the farmers of the Bridges of what's the name county in America,
Madison County.
They actually draw funding from their tourism bureau to maintain their oak trees because of the economics involved in the number of tourists coming to see that area. So that.
Mm-hmm.
Small things like that have definitely opened to my eyes.
Was something we talked about, though, was increasing the biodiversity, and that's another reason for planting anything that'll grow, and as many different species as possible. Mm. Biodiversity for the environment, but also for income down the track.
Mm.
And we had talked about tourism and things
We've just had Vicky's activities in the studio here. We've just had a group of what, 18 people were here for...
Yeah, well, they were 18 at one stage. And
there were 18 people just a couple of weeks ago, and they were here, and a lot of them were watercolour painters, and they were here basically because of the colours and the autumn colours and the, the patterns and things from the tree plantings.
We had painters all over the farm, spread out right across the farm, painting the landscapes here because of...
This was Min Atkinson?
She's a Queensland lady, but we also had an English lady here. She took her class up to the Tree Fest site in the morning. They were going to come back for morning tea. We saw them at lunch, which they gobbled down and flew back up there, and we didn't see them till 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and they said, the tutor, she said, if she could do that at every workshop, she'd be in seventh heaven. But it was a beautiful day.
I'll just add in there too, what was that, 7 years ago, we started hosting a big land care event for school children held up here on the New England tablelands called Frog Dreaming. And it's it's a two-day environmental workshop conference for year six, so year age 11, 12 school students.
Mm.
And they actually come out, they were coming out to the property here. It's got a big, there's a big cultural part to the conference.
Mm.
But the landscape side of it is also very important. And we actually hosted that for 4 years. And the kids come out and camp overnight. So they spend two full days out on the property. And we actually involved my job, apart from being host, was to actually involve them in some of the tree plantings that we were doing, and including a 250 metre long forest that can be seen from the air in the shape of a frog. You can see that on Google Maps if you want, or as you fly from Armidale to Sydney if you've got sharp eyes. I definitely wouldn't recommend planting trees in the shape of a frog. It's quite complicated. But it's small things like that have added a huge amount of interest and attraction to inspiration to continue. It definitely the farm is my garden, and it's.
We were talking about complexity, biodiversity, and in the car earlier, John, you were talking about field work that was done by the university counting insects on different plots of soil. Would you just like to summarise that?
Mm. Yep. Well, it's some. I don't know how well I can put it together, but basically. They were interested in monitoring a whole lot of aspects of what was going on the farm with all the tree planting that we're doing, because it was a larger scale tree planting, and they were able to get students and some funding to be out here and actually collect samples and monitor things. And one of the things they did was to take an interest in the insects, you know, remembering that the dieback in the New England was caused largely by a build-up of certain insect species, and it didn't have enough counter controls to it, and so it sort of overdid the job of defoliating trees and producing huge numbers of beetles. So they went along the rows of planted trees that were still, the crown of the tree was, you know, only 15 feet high or so, so it was easy for them to run a net along and collect a lot of insects. And they went along the native ones, and the particular insect species, or, you know, like the spider family or what have you, they were able to collect something like 40 different species on the eucalypt trees. And then when they ran their nets along the mixtures of pines and poplars and things like that, we didn't have many oaks at that stage, but the poplars and pines in particular, they collected the insects off those, and they discovered there were approximately 40 different of these
families of
insects. And and then they took them back and they identified them more closely in the lab, and they discovered that out of that 40 on one lot and 40 on the other, there was only about...
Two.
I exaggerated saying yes. Four because yes. I always... there were only a very small number of insects that actually overlapped and were on both trees, and so... There was a very considerable argument that planting the diversity of trees has considerably diversified the insect population, and therefore checks and balances between the insect varieties.
Yeah, unfortunately they couldn't carry on and do more research as to which were good insects and which were bad. They were pretty certain that the ones on the exotics would have been bad and the ones on the natives were good. You know, that was as far as it went. And it's a shame that they couldn't have done it.
We've also found koalas living in our pine trees.
Yes.
And that actually took quite a while to convince people that, until we had photographic evidence. And
I've had that too at home.
That's right.
90 yeah. feet up.
Yep.
And this, I think, although I haven't read it yet, is partly what Charles Massey was interested in when he came to visit you.
Yes.
If you would just like to comment on his observations and his subsequent writing.
Right. Okay. Well, Charlie Massey was the initial... contact with the family was because he was at university with my sister and her husband in Canberra, and they always wanted to sort of, you know, be on a farm together, and Charlie obviously had his own farm and that. So they've kept in touch over the years, and Charlie drops in and catches up with the family here as he goes past sometimes, and he was aware that we were doing a lot of this tree planting. So when he started to realise on his farm down there that there was some pretty interesting stuff to sort of give some deep thought, and to collect more information for his book. He came and he studied closely what we'd been doing because of the scale we'd been doing it on. And of course he went to several other places, even in this area, that had also sort of come up with new ways of managing the land. And so he discovered that there were some good points about what we were doing here.
Yeah,
and
his,
wrote about that in his
book. His book's about the he first of all discusses the damage that white people have done to the land in Australia since 1788, and with disastrous consequences for the Aboriginal people and the natural landscape. And he discusses the fact that humans change the landscape, but the landscape can also influence people.
Can adapt.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And it's an adaptation on both parts, I guess, humans and the natural world. And then he's used case studies, I guess, to show how people are tackling the problem and how they're trying to rejuvenate, renew the landscape, not to the way it was, but to a better state, a healthier state. So I've just started his book. It's quite depressing for a start, but then I gather it improves with optimism that people can change things and make a difference. So,
what did he say? Because I gather there is a section on his place in there. Did he had some observation about bird species numbers?
That would have been information that we gave him the bird species numbers. Definitely increasing since we've been.
We've had a huge increase in the number of birds on this place. Not just the numbers, you know, there were probably at the lowest point, there may have only been 50 magpies that lived on this farm. And that was just the magpies. There were obviously crows and, you know, wedge-tailed eagles and a few of the more common things. Now I'd say the number of magpies is in the thousands. And the number of birds is, you know, sighted during a 12-month period has probably gone from something like 80 up to like 120 or 30.
You're talking about species?
Yes.
Species, yes.
Yes.
And a lot of species that we never saw before have come back here and presumably would have been here at some stage, but they've come back because they've got the shelter.
And food, all those insects.
We have black cockatoos that are the winter over every year now, feeding on pine cones and finding more local nesting sites. Just in regards to Charlie, a lot of his work, early work with his PhD, was on investigating what had driven farmers to change the way they were doing things, and a lot of farmers have faced a serious situation of whether it's been a drought or a flood or a loss of landscape or dramatically low commodity prices or something that's forced them to rethink the way they've had to do everything. And I think I've always heard my father and my mother say that it was in the landscape. It just didn't feel right. And it's tipping points like droughts and things that have changed the way people have changed the culture of the way people think about things. They've been forced to. So I think while a lot of farms are going along, still making a small profit, it's not necessarily the aesthetics and social benefits that are going to change the way other properties do things. But that's what I was saying.
Can I?
But the evidence is continuing to build again.
Yeah.
Like I said, the economic benefits of those things are building up slowly, and
Just reverting to a comment you made, in town I noticed that the parrots, which I have huge numbers in the garden, because I have a lot of oak trees, and they come and they arrive for the oaks. Mm-hmm. And as for native animals not being able to exist on exotic species, it just ain't so. Whether it's fruit trees or vegetable gardens oaks.
Around here, the parrot species picked up a lot. We've got a lot of cotoneasters and pyracanthus and a lot of those berries too. You know, they come and pick every single seed and take a little nibble out of it and drop the rest. And they're very wasteful, but nevertheless,
well,
there's
can
food
be in this,
for them.
This
and,
scene of bounty. they can afford to be wasteful.
And here often in the springtime and early summer in particular, you can sit down on a seat there and there would be no time during the day that you couldn't see birds flying to and from somewhere.
Yes.
It's not just one or two down the garden like it used to be. It's just a sky. It's full of them and the trees are full of them.
The last few years have seen lots of groups of choughs, apostle birds, choughs round, and it's just a real joy. Secret joy. You come around the corner and see a group of choughs ruffling around in the leafy litter or...
All trashing the veggie garden.
or competing with the magpies.
Do you keep a register of birds?
No. Oh, yeah, well, only from the kitchen window.
Yeah.
So
anytime
we see something different, it's marked off in the bird book.
Yes.
We try and identify them.
Yes.
And,
a really important thing to do, I think.
You're continually finding birds that we found a drongo in the garden, and we'd never really registered.
I've had a drongo.
Have you?
Yes. The only one.
It's pleasant on watching. Every afternoon, the satin birds and the male bow birds come out. We've got two or three. Three bow birds and a mob of females there, and it's interesting watching them. And my mum hated satin birds.
Yes, I'm not very partial either.
No, she said if we got more than two, to do something about it. But you can't be environmentally responsible only in certain areas.
You're more pure than your mother?
No, I think just... realising that you can't be too
selective.
Yeah, selective.
You have to take a little bad with the good.
That's right.
You have to trust in Mother Nature correcting some of the imbalances.
You've got to take the long view,
as
we've been saying.
She'll sort it out.
Well, I had noted down before we started this, before I left home, that I would need to get you to make observations about the wisdom of the years. I think we've done a lot of that already, but it nevertheless is critically important for you to not only have the awareness, but and pass your information on, but have some sort of set-down recognition of the progress of change. Have you kept diaries, or do you keep a record of photographs, or do you...
Some of those photos.
And this is more... Are you doing more of this, would you say, Michael?
Yeah, look, I think we already had... my parents already had a little bit of a record. They'd taken a lot of photos of early plantings. But recently my aunt, my father's sister, Jane McMillan, she's added to the written history of the family that had been done by Liz Gardner in Terrible Vale, No Time Like the Past. There was already a lot of pictures, photos, old photos that were collected in that, but the emphasis there was on the historical content in people terms, probably of those people and structural terms in those photos. And my aunt Jane has recently brought together a lot of old photos, slides and negatives and printed photos into a collection. Digitized all those to hand around to all my cousins and family members.
Mm.
But for me, one of the most interesting things has not actually always been the people in the portrait, but the trees and the and what's going on behind.
Mm-hmm.
Where are those trees behind that building or beyond that fence, or mm-hmm. what are those the trees that those sheep are standing under, and
mm-hmm.
and look, all those trees are gone now, and
mm-hmm.
I've been able to go back and. In the last few years, I've been re-photographing a lot of those and finding new photos that to take photo mm. reference.
And this comparison and that you've kindly prepared yeah. for us,
yep.
It is truly instructive for not just family, but for people to see the amazing difference.
Anybody that comes here wants to know, you know, what it was like before, and especially in photographs. So
it's easy to see the trees as they are now, but to see where we've come from.
Mm. Yes.
For us, I think we were so busy with our heads down.
Mm.
You don't think of recording what you're doing at the time.
Mm.
So much has been asked by other people, you know, what was it like? Have you got photographs? Yeah, we have actually, you know, I'm getting them out and putting them in a form.
That so may well be a hugely important thing for you to do.
Probably
because
hand draw and quarter us one. Yeah.
Well, it's been a really good objective measurement too of what's happening. It's still... again, the question came up earlier today, what percentage of tree cover do we have on the farm?
Mm.
There's still no really easy way of being able to measure that without sitting down and meticulously mapping
we did,
out.
We did have one person do that.
Yeah, but it was still done manually measuring out the area that the trees cover on the property. Mm. I've got a few different digital mapping platforms and ground cover platforms, but even those, and I'm still looking, but there's still no digital way that it's very easy, not cheaply to measure tree cover, but a photo, you know, photo says so much. It's not just interesting in the objective terms, but the aesthetics is.
And the tree health. I mean, there might
tree
you might
health.
Have, in the 50s, you might have had quite a big tree cover, but half of them might have been three quarters dead.
Well, I think having a lot of European visitors on the farm, something that always is asked is, you know, why are there so many dead trees?
Yeah.
And a lot of Australians don't even realise that, you know, eucalypts live half their life as a live tree and half their life as a dead tree, and that's. Now, a lot of our native animals have evolved.
It's just
to,
as important.
So you know, being able to look back at a photo and see how many dead trees were around too is just as important as how
and
many.
A lot
dead
of people
trees
ask us what percentage and that we were aiming for, and down in Victoria, the people we were dealing with often spoke about a 20% tree cover. So we thought, right, that's something to aim towards.
Mm.
And then we realised that there's a big difference between having 20% in one corner of the farm and nothing, or having it right the way across. But once you get to 20%, you don't stop.
No.
And it's like being a gardener. You don't stop, do you? Gardening, because of the physical work usually. But you don't say, okay, that's it, I've done it all.
Yeah,
not doing it. You just keep going.
So you could really say this is very crude, but it is your a garden on a very big scale that you're trying to nurture things that are successful,
definitely,
and useful,
and probably And now for us, we can sit back and enjoy it as a garden, where for Michael, he's still got to make a living and look after a family. So his priorities are slightly different to ours.
But that's, you know...
But then he's a photographer. He's something to photograph.
The aesthetics are just as important. And because I'm in a position now, I'm deciding where the trees go. And I'm driving the tractor with the ripper behind, and I'm going... No, actually, I think I'll put in an extra row here. I'd like a vista through here, so I'm not going to plant trees here. I think a little bit of colour here would be good. I'm going to select some.
Almost capability brown.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, yes. More capability brown than, some of the other cottage garden. What's the name?
I do own 4 chainsaws and a number of pruning implements, and through our experience with agroforestry, we now recognise the significance of managing trees, whether it's pruning or thinning or removing is just as important as the establishment. And
we've got other problems, like the weeds change, but they're always a problem, and you get blackberries now in amongst the tree lines, which are difficult to get rid of, and it's terrific harbour for foxes and kangaroos and that's so, and you know, people, your problems are
some
changing.
Some people, when those, like, you see those contour plantings there, when they go to muster that paddock, they're just... So it's just impossible, you know, to get every last sheep because they hide behind trees there or somewhere else, or you hunt the mob and you can't get through the row, you know, when their trees are just a low height, they've got a lot of low branches and you can't ride your motorbike between them.
I have actually, you know, it's a job that my dad would never have had to do, but one of my jobs for the kids or backpackers that we have here or workmen is pruning trees purely so you can get your motorbike between them to catch the sheep as they come out the other side. It was a job that we didn't have to do before, but it's so, you know, that's something that comes when I'm planting trees now. I'm going like, these trees are quite near this gate, maybe I should leave a few more gaps
Oh, we've got to stop this wind somehow. We'll plant more and more and more.
So there was a lot of... One thing that I thought of just a little while ago that didn't make a mention of is that Vicky's actually kept a pretty good record of not of the exact numbers of trees, but of the species and a lot of the things that were collected and where they were collected and that. And a lot of those trees, she's also organised labelling, you know, a peg in the ground with a label on it saying what certain species were. And so that it's easy enough for people to match them up that want to sort of follow up on the...
It's like a family tree, isn't it? Yeah. Everything keeps changing. Somebody pops in something that I haven't recorded or something's died, so...
We had a lot of people interested in oaks here 12 months ago, and Michael took them around, and he was able to... we were able to, you know, talk about which varieties were which, and people could understand them, and they actually have labels there. So there are a lot of other people in Australia quite interested in expanding into the oak.
And just going back to the analogy with domestic gardening, in the last generation, garden visiting has become so... It's pleasurable, but it's a wonderful way for non-gardeners
really
to see the benefits. Absolutely. But I can see you people have done this on a much, much bigger scale in terms of numbers and
events. Well,
they're
not going to notice if the beds haven't been weeded.
No, but you are. It is both a diverting and an educative experience for people, whether they're farmers or they're forestry people or they're insect people. They are coming to a resource centre that you have very...
Which has
been
happened
amazingly
accidentally,
generous.
Really.
Maybe. But you can always... There's always the word no. And you have plainly...
Well, that's how we learn. And any new gardener, anybody that says, now, what are we going to plant? I say, well, visit all the gardens in your area.
See what you see, it's obvious.
And even the old homestead sites where there's no buildings left, there's always some trees there.
You can tell you where the sites were by the trees.
And you see how long some trees will survive.
With absolutely no care whatever.
That's right.
Cemeteries are a bit like that too.
Yeah, I don't go to cemeteries so much.
That's a dead idea.
Lynn, you've been listening so quietly and politely. Have you... Are there things that I should have covered, asked?
Oh, no. There's one thing that fascinates me is your father. Because he must have been... I mean... Your generation and your generation are very... What you're doing within your generations is really special and rare. But in your father's time, it would have been even rarer. What motivated him? What inspired him to start doing what you carried on?
Well, I guess, you know, living through that period when the dieback was at its worst... And you'd look around and you'd see every eucalypt tree just totally stripped of leaves and dying. It was, even if it was a wet season, it was like a drought in the sense that that the trees were dying. And
yeah,
that
it would
was,
have been from a farm management economical
yeah, yeah. But Granny always, the story I always heard was Granny would talk about, so my father's mother, my Granny, she... Pat Taylor, she talked about being able to walk from our house to the letterbox, which is 2 kilometres
in the shade
the whole way.
Yeah.
And I'm sure
my grandfather would have seen that disappear.
So that was significant. And again, looking back at the photographic record, you can see quite clearly the decline already.
He was a very quiet person. And he was a really good manager, so he would never really come across criticism from his friends or family or neighbours, because people are really sensitive to that. And in this day and age, with social media and that, it's even 1,000 times worse than when we were doing it. But I think in a lot of ways he probably was able to escape under the radar and was able to think about what needed to be done in a very measured, thoughtful way without having to worry about what anyone else thought.
Did his neighbours do similar things?
Not really.
There was a little bit of tree planting in some places around, but not... A huge
there
lot.
Was the Kentucky area with the orchards and the trees.
That was very
monocultural.
Yeah.
It was, but they were using the trees, the pine trees, for shelter. And, he would have seen that every day that he was passing through there. But it's not like he went travelling or visiting or had a huge library of gardening books. He didn't have any of those things.
And what do you say about... John's father, you certainly wouldn't apply to your parents, who were hugely influential, in fact, on this development too. I mean,
yes,
much travel,
and they were
extremely
really good friends
well, yes,
with
really,
John's parents, you
really
know,
real,
so.
Well read, and activists. Different personalities, but with that same. Curiosity of mind in the same field of endeavour. You're a lucky fellow.
Yes.
Well, either that or we've given him some problems too.
if you drive, for example, from Gostwick around the back road, around through Mai High, and come up through Dangersley, there is nothing.
There's not much.
No, so that's a different mindset.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. It's the mindset that fascinates me. The fact that your parents on both sides stepped outside that, it's dieback, we can't do anything. And I've heard that, I hear that still today.
Yeah.
you know, there's nothing we can do. It's just die back and, oh, it's the Christmas beetle.
Just has to take its course.
I think the area that you just mentioned out to the east of here, that's something I have noticed in the aerial photographic record. If you look back at some of the older aerial photographs, and obviously they don't go back a long way, but even the difference between the property here and the block that my sister's on, which is only 8 kilometres to the east, they had a lot more remnant native vegetation on that side.
Awesome.
And you look at the aerial photographs now, the area around Kentucky and on the top of the tablelands where a lot of the early dieback had occurred, there is a huge number of tree lines that have been planted, windbreaks. But you go further east and you don't see those, because when those tree lines were being planted, they still had a lot of remnant vegetation on the eastern side. And I'm seeing a secondary wave of dieback that's occurring. So a lot of those farms that were quite happy with the amount of tree cover they had a nice scattering of 15 to 20% tree cover, which was ideal. And there's nothing with industrialized farming, the regeneration of those trees hasn't been occurring. And we've had the dry years, and we've had other pressures, and you see a storm go through, like recently out near Ebor there, near Wallamumbi, and they had a nice scattering of trees, but one storm has wiped out 50% of those trees. And that's a big loss of well-established, 60, 80, 100-year-old trees.
Yeah, and also when you think about the Nivisons, we're here, the same, settled the area at the same time, and Jock Nivison in particular from Myalgu, he was doing similar things to what your dad was doing. They did the fertilising and increased the stocking rates and saw huge jump in their production and obviously the money they were able to make, but they would have both realised at similar time that things were changing. And Jock doesn't have a huge garden, but they were gardeners, and he was starting to plant tree lines like you see along the Walker Road at the same time, and he was part of the dieback and they were from different areas and different backgrounds, but came to the same realisation at the same time. And like Michael said, this was the first area really to be hit by what we call New England dieback. And now if you drive from here to Melbourne, we're saying, oh, they're going to cop it. Oh, they don't realise. Oh, you know, they're not doing anything about it. You can see that they're just following on behind what we'd been through. So
it's just been delayed, a delayed effect.
Well, this has been truly fascinating. I feel really privileged to be sitting here with you people. And I would like to thank you very much for participating.
Well, it's people like you that keep us going.
It makes us have to think about why we're doing it.
it makes us think about justifying what we're doing.
But it will be much more than that, I think. People will read, and not just now, but maybe in future generations, and hear voices from this table looking back and also looking forward to what's
you guys are doing your own thing too. We've been, we've heard about you forever and visited your garden. No,
this is not the time or the place.
We're going to interview you now.
But thank you.
But it's a two-way street.
Yes, I do thank you. And it has been just a wonderful morning. So thank you.
Thank you for visiting.
Thank you very much.
Glad you've enjoyed it, yeah.
Yes.